Unfiltered opinions.
Sometimes you have ideas and you're not quite sure why.
As you secure the bag.
Sometimes you meet people and realize there's probably a reason why you stayed in touch.
Just listen.
Sometimes all the pieces just come together by themselves.
Woo! I'm Jimmy Maliana.
And I'm Simon Brown.
Welcome to Insider Exchange.
Good morning. Welcome to another episode of Insider Exchange. Welcome to Market Matters, live streamed for your viewing pleasure. Every Monday, live on YouTube, on TikTok. We could figure out where to go live as well, on other platforms as well. I suppose Instagram, we could try go live there. Sean's joined us in studio again. He's going to be dropping his rap album at the end of this episode, so stick around for that. Sean, thanks for coming through.
You're welcome.
We're going to be taking a look at a couple of things in our Market Matters today. We're going to be taking a look at some issues, mostly that have affected South Africa, or that will continue to affect South Africa in various aspects. We're going to be taking a look at the interest rate decision that we got last week, or lack thereof, depending on how you qualify that. We're going to be looking at the movements on local companies, the likes of ArcelorMittal and Naspers, having big moves and making big announcements as well. We're also going to be reflecting on what could potentially be some awkward conversations that have been happening around climate investments as it relates to South Africa and the US. We're going to kick the show off and we're going to see how things are going. Before we do that, I just need to grab something because we're trying new things. We like trying new things on this show.
Where's Jimmy going?
Please don't fall.
We're going to try having coffee discussions because these things seemingly take longer.
For sure.
Thank you.
I would say shout out to Starbucks, but no, they're not sponsoring this. This came out of our pockets.
No shout out.
But if they do want to sponsor it, hey guys, we're happy to have a conversation. Let's get straight into it. Let's get into the developments around, I actually don't even know where to start. I suppose let's start with the normal things. Interest rate decisions coming through, US, South Africa, no rate cuts. We built up to this last week. We didn't expect rate cuts. And you almost get the sense that it's like, yeah, business as usual. No one cares.
Yeah.
You know what? I think there's just been a flood of information and news and volatility. I know someone in this room doesn't like me talking about Donald Trump, but, you know, everything is driven by Uncle Donald, right?
In case anyone's confused out there, it is not anyone sitting at this table.
By the way.
It's our ghost behind the mics. Yeah, so Donald?
Look, I think it was strategic from our point of view to hold. Because we obviously don't know what's going to happen in the future. I mean, we basically in a trade war, or the world is in a trade war, in my opinion. I don't want to call it a potential trade war because...
No, we're in it.
We're definitely we're inside it.
China's throwing back tariffs. Canada's retaliating. We're in it.
Exactly. So as much as our inflation has been steady, there's no need for us to rush. I know it's not good on the consumer side, but we've got to look at it from the largest picture. Like, that's how I interpreted what, you know, the Reserve Bank was saying or what they did. I was like, okay, good move for now.
Sai?
So the US one I get, right? I mean, what Powell's talking is that he is seeing inflation ticking higher in their data and growth down. So be careful. Although, was it the Chicago Fed man who said there's still going to be three cuts this year? And they better hurry up because it's like, you know, almost
quarter
April.
One done.
Yeah.
He's not wrong. At the end of this week, Q1 is done.
No, quarter one done.
Yeah.
Locally, I'm not so sure though. I mean, we have immensely high real interest rates. Our drivers of inflation is not demand driven at all. It is either imported, although that's fading away with oil and the rand at their current levels. It's Eskom, which, you know, is going to hit us with 12% or so at the end of quarter one, and you know, the rates don't have any difference for that.
You bring up Eskom and it's just such a painful
fun fact
thing.
Is that Khaleesi, which one of the power stations is finally done, I think 12 years late and three times overpriced. They synchronized it last night to the grid.
Oh yes, I saw that announcement. Eskom gave us an announcement that they've added 800 megawatts to the grid. My concern is less around Eskom adding to the grid. And when you look at Eskom's reports, it's around the unplanned outages. Those equate to almost enough, as much as the electricity being generated. I mean, how do you have more than 10,000 megawatts of unplanned outages or unplanned maintenance? Or anything unplanned should not be in that amount. You should have some form of control in there. But that's not on this section of Market Matters. That's not the conversation for today. That's the conversation we battle with every day. I want to circle back to Trump for a sec. And that's because it's primarily because the United States has exercised its authority on climate investments. South Africa's been going on a huge climate drive. We know the president has been very vocal around climate investments. Shout out to Jimbo and those that have joined us on our YouTube live stream. We welcome you in the chat. But yes, back to Trump. The investment side of it has been a big thing for our country. We've always said, oh, we're the first country to be part of the just energy transition in terms of investments and rollouts and that whole plan, right?
100%.
Europe has come out last or 2 weeks ago with an announcement that they're committing more than 4 billion, I think it was 4 billion euros to us and all of that. And in the past, we've also secured funds from the likes of the World Bank and the IMF for climate investments. It seems there is a portion of funds that was said to be released by the United States that will catalyze the release of other funds that the US is now delaying. Now, I'm not going to say I'm surprised, and I don't think any of us are really not expecting this. But what I found interesting was they said alongside that, some of the other funds that are supposed to come after that were conditional upon this release.
Exactly.
So now my question then becomes, if you are a EU or anyone else or any other country or organization that has committed funds subject to this release, and you can see the visible tensions between South Africa and the US, are you now suddenly going to not release funds to us because the US is not? Because that's now the non-release on this side is no longer because of us not meeting climate goals. It's because of political tensions.
Yeah.
Now, as another organization, right, say an IMF or whatever private Asian infrastructure investment bank kind of thing, right? Are you now not going to release your commitment because you're saying, oh, you didn't get that first draft? Or are you going to overlook it and say, you know what? Whatever political stuff is happening there, this was our commitment.
I think that.
The way you said Jimmy, you're just like Jimmy.
No. If we look at, you know, Trump, when he came in, I mean, it's one of, when we're speaking about the climate, right? He came in and he came out of that Paris Agreement. He says, look, the United States is coming out of this, et cetera, right?
Mm.
So that's already a sign that, you know, this is his direction outside of, you know, the political landscape that, you know, he's playing around with South Africa. So he was always on that thing. So I think from there, he's making us an example outside of, again, the politics behind it. He's making us an example and saying, okay, guys, I'm not really into climate change without really saying it out loud.
But he has said it out loud, Sean.
Fair enough. Okay, fair enough. So
when the United States withdrew from the Paris Accords and the Paris Agreements, and what's Trump's motto?
Which one? The burn it down.
One. No, the other one. The drilling one.
Oh, drill.
Drill, baby, drill.
That's the one. So he's been very vocal that he doesn't care about the climate.
From a EU perspective, right, we cannot, you know, stop sustainability goals because we have...
Because one person in the world decides no.
Has decided against it, right? But when it comes to, you know, the contingency of them bringing in money, I don't know what the T's and C's are.
That's true. You haven't seen the agreements.
At the end of the day, I can, you know, circumvent this and decide, okay, I'm still going to pump money in, but how does it affect me as a nation or as a region? So that's, you know, something I've no answer to, but something I'd assume they'd look into in order for them to decide whether or not should we forget about what he said. Anyways, we're going to give the funds, well, I mean, the funds are there for them to say, if you guys put in this much, we'll put in X amount, meaning that the X amount is there. So what stops us from, you know?
So I think what stops is that there's probably sort of contracts that now need to be changed. You can't just unilaterally say, well, step whatever hasn't happened, therefore
we're just going to jump,
carry on.
Yeah, yeah. So there's addendums and amendments.
But I do think,
things.
Surely I would imagine they do that. They
that
make
sense prevails.
Well, and they adjust accordingly.
Let's move to some developments that we saw last week. I want to leave the ArcelorMittal conversation for last, but I want to look quickly at the Tencent Naspers developments from last week. Tencent comes out, gives us numbers. Numbers are nothing short of impressive, considering a challenging gaming environment and all of that, and Chinese regulation
in general.
And the market chose to ignore all of that and be like, well, Alibaba's spending $50 billion on AI. You guys are not spending any on AI, so therefore we're going to sell off Tencent. Because that's the only thing I could see. There was no other logical reason as to why. I mean, forecasts weren't down significantly to the extent that you could justify that. They announced a massive share buyback, and I suppose the market was like, you're buying back shares instead of plowing it into AI, we're going to sell off. But at the same time, can you blame Tencent?
Look, I think what I've been seeing this year in general, and I think we've all observed it, is that markets are not reacting how we expect them to react. Obviously, we cannot predict the markets, right?
Mm.
But there is a general trend. What happens when good news comes out?
Yeah.
What tends to happen is that, you know, the share price should go up in the green. I think since the news came out, it's down like 5% this morning, or since last week when the news came out. And I honestly think that, you know, the AI game, right, is what's driving a lot of, let's call it, sentiment in individuals. Because if we look at, we go back to the Magnificent Seven, you know what I'm talking about. You know, they really drove the markets positively last year under extreme circumstances of high interest rates, high inflation, et cetera, et cetera. But it was AI this, AI this, AI that, right? So if a company comes in, yes, the gaming company, and like you mentioned, Alibaba is coming in, they're investing $50 billion in AI. And you guys, yes, you've had some great results, but how come we're not moving into, let's call it, the future?
Mm.
That's the only way I can make sense of, you know, how the market reacted from a share price perspective, because it's almost, yes, great results, but he's still against the trend, if that makes sense. Just my opinion.
I think you're 100% spot on. And I think it is these days AI. You folks don't remember the days of the dot-com boom, where all you had to do to plow your stock up 100% was add a dot-com to the end. Or I forget who it was. Some random business got a website. It was like, maybe, I don't know, Walmart or something. And all the website was a one-pager with a logo and an address for the head office. Like no email address, nothing, just like maybe a telephone number. Mm. And stock went up 10%. They added billions in value. And it's like, 25 years later, Walmart is rocking in online, sure. But it was just the hype. And the stocks that didn't have were just completely and absolutely left behind and unloved and uninterested. You had to have something around .com. And I think AI's fit is 25 years later, the new thing. I think it serves purposes and places. I think long-term for AI, I think AI is a game changer. I think it's like electricity. It's like internet. It's like personal computers. But think of internet, personal computers, electricity and stuff. Who got the value? Everyone. There's no company which is, well, that's the power company, or that's the computer company, or that's the internet company.
Mm.
And it got, you know, it's now absolutely ubiquitous. It's absolutely everywhere. And I think it's going to be in the same with AI. You know, Microsoft will be a winner, not because of their stake in OpenAI, but because of Azure and the processing that they've got, and so on and so on. And I think it's just going to be that everyone wins, but right now, if you're not AIing, the market's like, you're missing something. So maybe we should add AI to our name of the
going on the wall later. That might actually make it to the wall later on. We're gonna take a look at a couple of things in our wall. We're gonna take a look at some surprises that we might want to put onto the wall that we haven't had the time to necessarily dissect. And AI is one of them. AI, I think, is one of those things where, as you say, Si, it's been very topical. A lot of the investment goes into that. We're also going to take a look at the likes of MultiChoice. And if you're interested to find out what we're dipping into in our deep dive, we are going to be diving into the world of credit scores, understanding your credit score, managing your credit score, and hopefully helping you improve your credit score. We're going to wrap up this segment in a moment. I want to look at ArcelorMittal. They had been having the toughest time for the longest time, to the extent that after many warnings about closing down the long steel business, they took a decision to close down that long steel business. More than 3,000 jobs were going to be impacted. And I think I saw it over the weekend, last week, it was tail end of last week into the weekend, the government bailing out ArcelorMittal. Now, that doesn't happen every day because for those that don't remember, for those that have a bit of a faded memory, fuzzy memory, so to speak, ArcelorMittal used to be the old Iscor. So used to be the old steel company owned by the government, went private, was listed, now kind of going
so
through
Exaro
a bit of a...
Exaro and Kumba were part of that too.
Yes. Yes, Exaro and Kumba spun out of the old Iscor into their own.
I remember that listing in the late 80s. I got the newspaper, I cut out my thing, I wrote my name, sent my 1,000 rand check, got my 1,000 shares for 1 rand a share, terribly exciting, sold them at 1 rand 30, like, I don't know, 2 weeks or 3 weeks later, thought I was the cleverest teenager in all of Pinetown, and well, I should have hung on. That's how we did IPOs in those days.
Wow. You know what? One of these days we're going to dip into the trading world because we all have a bit of trading experience. Sean and I used to work together at a trading company. He still does at Tribe. And of course, I still sit on that advisory board. But I want to look at that. I want to look at how things have transitioned from the days of paper trading to now, as you said, with the introduction of AI, you can close your eyes, have an AI bot trade everything for you. Maybe we should do that. We should dip into that. I just want to take a look at what you were saying around ArcelorMittal. You said you bought in at 1 Rand and you sold at 1 Rand 30. Yeah. If you had to rebuy in today into ArcelorMittal, you'd get in at 1 Rand 31. So you're not that far off.
Well, no, but also I had Kumba and Exxaro. Remember, it was all three together.
Ah, fair enough.
But
fair
that
enough.
Is an intuitive. Actually, it's trading 130. It was the price. But to
what a throwback, right?
Yeah. And they would post you a share certificate, and then you'd have to post it to your in the mail. It would like come
before Computer Share existed as a CompuShare existed as a company.
Yeah, literally share certificates. It was wild. Wow. I think steel is strategic. What we're seeing right now in the steel price is a glut from China, and China is looking at steel as strategic. We've had Donald Trump nix the Nippon Steel trying to buy U.S. steel because right now there's a global oversupply of steel, and China's just like, doesn't matter, let's carry on producing. But what if one day there's a global undersupply of steel and we don't make our own? How much trouble? I think there are some things that are of a national imperative, security,
national level. Importance, strategic national that's, reserves,
that and, type okay. of thing. Okay. It's not, and I think that steel is one of those. Right now, it seems weird, and it's 3,500 jobs, not unimportant. I mean, so on and so on. But I think that one day there won't be a global steel glut, and we need to be able to produce our own just in case.
And we have got the steel. We can do it. I mean, we export steel. We export chrome. We export manganese. We export 100%. So much that we can operate and play in that space. And even if we don't, I think the other thing that you're raising, Sai, around it being a matter of strategic importance is we don't necessarily need to export our steel. We don't have a shortage of infrastructure projects we can put it into. There's an abundance of infrastructure projects we can redirect the steel to. So it's never going to be a situation where South Africa's like, oh, we've got too much steel. We don't know what to do with it. Build more stuff. Build more schools. Build more roads. Mm-hmm. It goes into every part of infrastructure. So from our perspective, I agree with you. Strategic national importance. And I can see why the government then steps in and says, we will give you a conditional bailout on the salaries to save jobs and to save salaries for the 12 months. But at the same time, I am of the view that they need to do more around securing the steel sector. Yes. It's not enough to simply say, here, we'll pay for the salaries. Arcelor, go figure it out. Because Arcelor's big problem and the steel sector's big problem hasn't been around the fact that we don't know how to run a business.
Yeah.
It's been around the fact that the regulation and the policy around
And Eskom.
And you know what I mean? So fix those things because those are solely in your purview to resolve for an Arcelor. Because if you had resolved them 12 months ago, you wouldn't need to be bailing out an Arcelor at this point.
Yeah.
Exactly. There's a point I want to touch on, right? Interesting. So you said Arcelor's 1 Rand. Okay, you bought it for 1 Rand. 2 weeks later, it's 1 Rand 30.
Mm.
It's 2025, right? Cool. Let's call that 30 years later. And it's still 1 Rand 30. I wonder what that looks like for a new investor that's watching this show. It doesn't really work like that all the time. I'm just letting you know.
Yeah, no, purely coincidental.
Yeah, it grows sometimes.
It does. I want to zoom out. So actually, so my chart has ArcelorMittal all the way back to, so it looked like it was a 1990 listing, which is fair enough. I had left Pinetown by then, fortunately. So I would have been final year at Tech. It looks like, because I've actually got a price of 10. So maybe it was 10 Rand and it went to 30. Either way.
Price as high as...
Oh, there's a price.
2008, 265 Rand. So to go from 1 Rand to 265 back down to 1 is a completely different conversation. It just so happens that, like you said, Sean, it coincidentally ended up at 1 Rand 30 again today.
Yeah.
265 Rand. That tells you something as well, right? That tells you something about how good things can be. Because 265 Rand is peak April, May-ish of 2008. Yeah. The financial crisis.
But there was an end of the commodity boom. And wasn't, who was it? Which CEO, was it Exxaro, was it Arsenal, forgot to re-sign the deal with Sishen Iron Ore. And then we had this weird company pop up and grab the rights, which turned out to be the Gupta brothers and was the first time Imperial Crown Mining suddenly wanted the rights. And it turned out that was the first time we met the Guptas.
Oh, well, for some people,
I forget who it was. It was one of the Troika, and it might not have been Arsenal. It was more likely Exxaro and their rights and decisions, but literally just forgot.
Yeah.
And then the CEO, well, let's not go there.
Let's not go there.
Topic for another day.
Before I let you go, Sean, how was your coffee? Because we were talking about it before we went into the conversation. I think I got you one with a normal milk. We're having a raging debate about normal milk, alternative milks, and how you get there in between. And we learned something. The nice thing about the show is we're always learning new things. We learned the process of going from normal milk to lactose-free milk.
Distillation.
See, aren't you happy? Just like whiskey. Must be relatable. See, have to understand it.
Who's James?
Yeah, I was going to ask him who James is.
So James is a funny story, right? We've got a James in our community. But what happens with James is typically when I go into a store and I place an order, especially a Starbucks where you have to kind of give your name to something, I say Jimmy. And the variations that come out from the people that are listening, Jimmy, Timmy, Limmy, very few people actually just hear the Jimmy. Yeah. And then when you hear it, they're like, how do we spell it? How do we, you know what I mean? And I've just found it easier that, and I tried it once. I was just, instead of saying Jimmy, I was just like, James. And then they wrote James on the cup because that's, they somehow, everybody can hear and understand and, you know, and Jimmy's not really difficult to enunciate. Same amount of letters, starts with the same letter, ends with a different letter. But I then realized that sometimes it's easier to just use that. It's not my official name. It has nothing to do with me. It's not even on my birth certificate. It's just easier for me to have a conversation with the person on the other side of the counter and not have to explain to them. Next week, I'll try a new name. Next week, I'll be Simon.
So the trick is I would forget what name I've said.
I go with the easiest names to write down, easiest names to pronounce, easiest names to remember. Because also, the more complicated a name you give, if I had to give Sean... And your name isn't complicated at all, but there's so many different variations
of how to spell it.
Exactly. So are you going to write S-E-A-N on a cup? S-H-A-U-N? S-H-A-W-N? What happens? So to avoid confusing the person on the other side, it's just a courtesy from my side to say, just write James on the cup because you have to write a name on the cup. But what I will be trying, now that we've brought up James, is I'm going to be trying a bunch of different names. Please let me know in the comments, jump into our chats, jump into our socials. Let me know what names you'd like me to try out on our coffee cups and see how they react. I'll give you some feedback. I'll let you know which names are complicated to pronounce, which names are easier to write down, and which names just are a no-go. There's some people where you give the name and the lady or the gentleman on the other side just looks at you with a marker in their hand and just shakes their head. they draw a smiley face, shake their head, and move on.
You know what? Okay, it's okay.
That's it, right? So thanks, folks, for tuning in. Sean, thanks for jumping on with us. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to Trive. They are our partners, allowing us to continue to bring us to continue to bring you some of the good work that we hope to do. Until next time, that's been Market Matters. This week, we're diving into the world of credit scores. We're looking at how to manage your credit score, understanding your credit score, and most importantly, if we can help you improve your credit score, then we've done something a little bit better. We're going to kick things off with something that we found on X. So someone went on an ice cream date after work. Yes. And on the ice cream date, the gentleman asks the lady, what is your credit score? Have you looked at your credit score? Doesn't stop there. Goes on to take out his phone and show her his credit score. And she's sitting there wondering to herself, is this what things have come to?
Was this a first date? This seems like...
This is a first date,
it
seems.
You're thinking ice cream date would be casual.
Yes. No, but I need to know about your credit score. I need to know what I'm getting into.
Ice cream.
I need to know what I'm getting into. Very interesting times. You were in Bella Bella over the last weekend. Did anyone ask you for your credit score there?
No.
No?
No. Not one time. I didn't buy ice cream, though. I did buy other stuff, but not ice cream.
Well, we got bagels. So we tried bagels this morning. You can see the bagels in the shot. I didn't get asked for a credit score for the bagels, but I suppose each to their own. Anyone that wants to know these questions, these are important questions, though, right? So I don't blame the person for having this conversation. I think very awkwardly timed. I would have waited a few dates, maybe a few months, maybe just get to know someone's last name first before you kind of ask their credit score. It's a deeply personal thing, but it's also a fundamentally important thing that we need to be having a conversation about, because at the end of the day, whether we like it or not, the credit score affects how the working class is viewed in the eyes of the lender. And I say working class because, not to say that other people that are perhaps on the upper end or on the lower end of the working class spectrum, their credit scores don't really matter, but the bulk of the taxpayer is the working class. Mm-hmm. And when you are at a certain tax bracket and you're earning certain salaries that we've spoken about on the show before, then a credit score doesn't really matter to you. But to you and I, that get up, go sit in traffic every morning to get to an office, to get to a location, to go do everyday work, that don't have the luxury of private chauffeurs, that don't have the luxury of not having to worry about the credit score, this is a fundamentally important thing. And we're going to try and help everybody unpack that. I mean, it's one of these concepts that you have to understand, whether you're old, young, married, unmarried, planning to get married, have kids, no kids, it affects everybody, right? And I guess the starting point is at the very, very beginning is, what is it, how it's determined, and who decides on it?
So who decides is credit bureaus, and then occasionally they get hacked and then all sorts of chaos goes stuff.
So the likes of Experian, TransUnion, XDS, credit bureaus.
Yeah. So what they do is they collate all of your data about you in terms of what loans you've got, and they get it. So there's a symbiotic relationship where if I'm a bank and I'm a lender, I can query these credit bureaus and I also send the credit bureau's information. Mm. And to be clear, it's not anonymized. It has to be, this is Simon Brown, etc. And it tells you what debt you've got, what financial judgments you've got against your name, whether you're paying on time, whether you pay late, your credit utilization. I always get knocked on my score on mine because I don't utilize enough of the credit. And they then sort of create a profile. And the purpose behind this is so that when you go and try and get a home loan or a car or an Edgar's account, they can get an idea of your credit worthiness. How likely are you to pay back this money? The more likely you are, the better deal you get, the more likely they are to lend you money. Mm-hmm. If you've got a bad score and it says, you know, this Oak Et has never paid back their money every time they take a loan, that's useful information for lenders.
Mm. And when we look at that as well, I mean, from a lending perspective, it might not matter for certain things. It might not matter if Jimmy and Cy borrow 100 rand from each other, that sort of thing. But when we look at big ticket items, which everybody looks at, when you look at a car, when you look at a house, when you look at any significant debt that is probably beyond 100 rand really at this point, it does factor in. It factors in on things like clothing accounts as well, but that's always a good starting point, right? So I remember kind of coming into the working world and the first thing was get yourself an account, get yourself a clothing account, even if you don't use it that much, even if you don't need it and all of that, get it so that you can start building the credit profile.
Yeah.
And that's important because I want to look at, before we get into the payment histories and all of that, I want to look at length of credit history because the longer you've been an active kind of person to be monitored, the more beneficial that becomes for you. And a lot of the conversations that we have, and we'll look at this in the improvement side of it as well, length of credit history affects your improvements as well.
Yeah, it all does. And it all fits in together. And ultimately, they give you a score. And depending on the different ones give you different scores. Mm. What's your score?
My score, I think the scores range between 350 and 800. And I think the last time I had a look at my score, I check it periodically, not every single time, but the last time I had a look at it, we were around the 650 mark-ish. I haven't taken a look in a while.
So I just checked mine. I can do it on my app. Their score only goes up to 743. So that's it. There is different top levels.
Yes. Depending on which credit company and you're looking at.
Just for the record, my bank says I am exceptional.
Well done.
674 points of exceptional.
There we go. There we go.
So but it is. It is the duration of it. However, to your point that the folks go and say, you know, get a store card or something. Make sure you pay it off.
Mm.
There's also, if you've got insurance, I mean, anything that is pinging your bank account. So your insurance, which you pay regardless, because like that's not a voluntary. They reach in and take it. Well, you might not have money in the account, but that goes towards it. They still
reach in though.
Yeah, they try. Your telco, if you have a contract, all of those build your credit score. What they want to know is that when they reach in on the certain date to get X amount of money, that you will be good for it.
Mm.
And small things. I mean, I was renting a flat, and for the flat rental, they wanted to do a credit score. Companies will want to do it before they employ you because it gives you insights into people. If your credit score is 2, like no bank's going to employ you. They're not going to let you work with money if you've got no credit score. You're going to get, you're a risky individual.
Mm. The other thing is credit scores have become more and more interesting over time, to the extent that governments have been thinking about using them in electoral polling, in voting, in all sorts of things. And that's another conversation. I mean, from a political point of view, that's got many strings and layers to it as to why governments would want to do that and why the political sphere wants to know the credit worthiness of its voters. At the end of the day, your role as an elected official is to represent your constituencies and represent your voters, regardless of what their credit score is. But that's a conversation for another day. I want to look at the payment side of it. We spoke about this. We touched on some of the factors and payments being some of the factors that can affect your credit score. Mm-hmm. I want to look at some of the negative things and close the conversation off with positive things. Negative things that can impact your credit score. Missing payments, like you said. Missing payments is something that comes up quite often. And even if you miss 1 month, and I think for some credit bureaus, it can take up to 24 months for a missed payment to drop off from your credit profile. So when you miss a payment, it's almost like a black dot against your name, and then it takes a while for that to kind of disappear and roll off your profile. That's the one thing that can affect your profile. The other one is credit utilization. Mm-hmm. Now, Sai has got a very privileged position that he's in, and that's why the bank calls him exceptional, that he's underutilizing his credit. But for many people, what people don't know is that the moment you go beyond 50% of the utilization, in most cases, it can vary from creditor to creditor. The median is that 50-point mark. When you're using more than 50% of your credit card, more than 50% of your Edgar's account, more than 50% of any of your accounts, it negatively impacts your credit profile.
Yeah, and if you're using zero, it does too. Because it goes to the point that, you know, a credit card, and I know, how do we use a credit card? Bang it out and then pay it off and bang it out. That's not what it's meant to be for you. Like use a little, and then, which is weird because why give me the credit?
Absolutely. No, that makes a lot of sense.
Utilization. So it's non-payment. It's utilization. They want to see that you're managing it well, because really, as we said up front, this is around how they're going to decide many things. What you earn is also important. What you own is important. Mm. But this gives you a pattern of your ability to pay it and to be respectful of the contract, in essence, which is the debt contract.
Mm.
It's also too many accounts. Not enough accounts are both red flags as well. If you've only got like one MTN contract and that's it, and they're like, well, like,
why don't you have other credit? What's happening? Yeah, so it's a weird thing in South Africa because you can't have too much debt.
Correct.
But you also can't have too little debt because then they don't know if you can carry debt, regardless of what's happening in your financial situation. And there's, I mean, we've gotten varying views on this, but the crux of the matter is, as long as you are looking at your credit score and looking to improve that credit score, you're going to unfortunately have to play by the bank's rules and the credit provider's rules. So whether you like it or not, whether you agree with it or not, the system is not going to suddenly change because you and I have a personal view on it. It is the way it is. And the best thing you can do for you, for yourself, for those around you, is to work within the system. Yes. If you know the system requires these things, tick them as a tick box exercise. Your credit score goes up. It looks fantastic. And you kind of get what you want out of it. It serves its purpose. To that extent, I know people that have that kind of take the approach of saying every month a salary comes in and they throw the salary onto the credit card. It bumps up as it appears as a big payment. And it feels like manipulating the system.
Sure,
but,
sure, but
as we said, the system is not going to change. Do whatever you have to.
Do what you have to. Understand how it works. And it comes back to, weird for a first date, but you need to know what your score is. And my little bank here has given me 4 tips on how I can improve my score and become more exceptional, I suppose. I don't know. I mean, I'm loving the exceptional part.
Yeah.
And there are things that you can do. Now, go and get your reports. Importantly, don't pay for a report. Like, there are 100 places you can get it for free. And careful when you log in, man, because they try and sell you stuff. Now, I think...
they try and sell you stuff.
I think all the banks these days probably offer some type of credit score within their apps and online banking. So you don't need to...
We hope they would do that.
Yeah.
Those that are going to be giving out the money, you hope that they do that. I want to look at something. Before we jump to the improvements and the suggestions, I want to look at one last thing that can impact your credit profile. And that is... what they call hard and soft inquiries. So every time you go out and apply for new credit,
it gets recorded.
The inquiry itself, whether you take that credit on board or not, that inquiry gets logged. Now, the difference between hard and soft inquiries depend on what it is that you are going to inquire about. So, for example, something like So soft inquiries typically don't affect your credit score. And what soft inquiries are is when you consent to a credit check, for example, for a new job that you're applying for. Mm-hmm. That's not you applying for a new piece of credit. That is you granting anyone else, a prospective employer, the permission to go and look at your credit profile. They might not get an idea of exactly what your credit score is because it's a soft inquiry, but it is giving them access to that. And that kind of inquiry doesn't negatively impact you, but the hard inquiries do. The hard inquiries are when you apply for credit and that has a bearing. So if you go out and you apply to MFC, West Bank, someone financial services to apply for a vehicle. Those are hard inquiries from a vehicle perspective. And if you do more than one, more than two, more than three, each one of those is a separate inquiry. And therefore, each one of those can affect your credit profile. I think with vehicles, they allow up to 2 or 3 hard inquiries before it starts to negatively impact. So let's say, for example, you're comparing 3 vehicles.
Because you would be potentially...
You're allowed to compare, sure, right? Sure. So if I go out and I'm looking at buying the 3 German cars, a BMW, a Mercedes, and an Audi, right? And I go and put forward 3 different applications to 3 different dealerships. That's okay. The moment I go into a 4th one, then it starts to affect. Wow. And... again, we don't know these things. We don't know those golden numbers. You only know these things as you find out the process. But keep in mind, hard inquiries have a bearing. Hard inquiries are quite important. And they also take a while to come off.
They take a while to come off. And the key point there is, I mean, in your case, you're making sense, right? You were looking at 3 different cars. I would have gone Italian, not German, but nonetheless. are there 3 Italian cars?
Ferrari, Ferrari, Ferrari?
Ah, Fiat.
Well, you're exceptional in your exceptional case.
So absolutely. But you might, were they also looking at, you've made 10. Why didn't you get a vehicle? Like, what's
and that's that? It. Also with the loan side of it as well, as you say. Even if you don't intend on taking the loans or intend on taking whatever credit is being offered, avoid doing too many inquiries. And when you do take credit, the other part of it is when do you take it? So something I found recently was they say don't take on new debt just before you're looking to take on big debt. So if you're looking to buy a house, for example, don't suddenly go out and get a credit card or a personal loan or a car loan or whatever. I think it's in the 3 months or so before you're looking to take on that big debt, because it takes a while for your new debt to then work into the system because they have to monitor how you pay that new debt.
Okay. I did not know that either. Mm. Yeah. And it's this. I mean, it's go and find out what your credit score is. Find out how you can influence it positively and what might be negatively influencing it, but be in control of it. And back to the person and the date, it's not unreasonable on a first date, but it's not it tells you something about a person.
Mm.
If I say, what's your credit score? And you're like, what is that? It's like, well, okay, this gives me some information here. Now, you still might want to, you know, but it does tell you stuff that some folks are more in tune with their finances, some aren't.
Mm.
And we have access. You know, just 10 years ago, it was almost impossible to get your credit scores. Now we can. Now we can go and see what's driving it lower or higher, as the case may be.
Let's look at how to improve it. Let's wrap things up with how to improve your credit score, because that is very, very important, right? So I want to start by looking at some of the easy things, the easy wins, like the utilization, keeping utilization under 50%, regardless of what you, and that's difficult to do because sometimes you have pressing needs that kind of push you over that 50% level. We're all human, life happens and that sort of thing. So one of the easy ones is monitoring the utilization, right? As much as possible, keeping it under, but keeping an eye on it, because having it front of mind means you're consciously trying to better it.
Yeah.
That's an easy one. What's another one?
Pay on time. Mm-hmm. Have the money. Every time the money comes in, have the money. Mm-hmm. If you don't have it, contact the person you owe. Don't go hide, because that'll get onto there as well. In other words, engage with someone if you can't afford to pay them. But have the money. Make sure that you can make the payments. Don't have hundreds of accounts and you know, every single store in Rosebank Mall. Be selective where you have accounts at certain stores. Store accounts, they have their uses, but not every single store.
That's interesting, right? That's another one that I find interesting is go for the other options. South Africa now has new options. Guys like PayFlex, where I can take something, and this is something you also kind of see in the likes of Foschini, right? Mm-hmm. Where this is where it comes to you having conversations. Foschini have the option to, and Foschini is the TFG group, obviously. Mm-hmm. They have the option to pay over 12 months with interest mm-hmm. or over 6 months interest-free. Now, yes, over 6 months interest-free, you're going to pay a higher premium on a monthly basis because that debt is interest-free. But the likes of PayFlex as well, right? Those kinds of places. PayFlex is not a store account. Mm. But what it does allow you to do is it allows you to split your payments over a period of time without incurring debts and incurring heavy amounts. So take, for example, let's say you want to buy a laptop. Let's say this laptop's going to cost you 10,000 Rand over an upfront fee of 10,000 Rand, or you can split it over 4 monthly payments at 2,500 Rand each. Now, instead of going out and getting a loan for the 10,000 Rand to purchase the laptop, take the option like PayFlex, where you're not negatively impacting your credit score.
So, fun fact, they don't report to the credit bureaus. All those buy now, pay later.
That's it, right? But use that very, very carefully, folks, because the moment you go down that rabbit hole, when you go beyond those monthly payments that are stipulated, you start to incur interest and interest.
And then it does get quite ugly. So they work. I got a friend and she was looking to buy a washing machine. But the one she could afford wasn't very good. The one that she wanted was expensive, so she did a buy now, pay later. And it's perfectly, you know, she's got a job, she can afford, I think she did it over 3 payments. It's interest-free, it's perfect.
And that's the thing, right? Yeah. So those sorts of easy wins there, low-hanging fruit that you can implement on a daily basis, that you can kind of manage for yourself.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it comes back to what we said around the system. It's there. If you can find and understand how the system works, it's not manipulating the system. It's operating within the bounds of the system, managing it responsibly, and that's it. I think a final parting thought around the improvements side of it and a conversation around the improvement side of it is looking at things around the length and the history. And we spoke about this at the start of the conversation.
Yeah.
I said we'd circle back to it here. For some people, the question has been asked, is it better to pay down and remove something from my credit profile entirely, or to leave it on there? And that's quite an interesting thing as well, because when credit bureaus put together the score, they measure how long you've had a credit history. So say, for example, you've had a Markham or a Edgar's account for the last 15 years, and you finally got that account to a point where you can pay it up at zero and close that account. I, for one, don't think it's beneficial that you close it, because when you close it and it eventually drops off your profile,
you lose all that.
You lose 11 years or 15 years of history.
As long as you've been paying it well, and as long as that's it's interest free.
So if you've been paying something exceptionally well, you've got the utilization rate down, you're managing that debt, you're not leaning into it as much, and you're able to get it down to a comfortable below 50% utilization and all of that. Paying it up might not necessarily be in your best interest.
Yeah, I hear you 100%. Watch out for, like, there might be an admin fee or something.
Yes, of course, assuming
all things equal, keep running it.
And that admin fee as well. I mean, if you look at that admin fee, it could be 50 Rand or so relative to whatever. And then you can look at it as a 50 Rand for keeping that credit thing active rather than an admin fee. And that could be a good thing for you. So that could be something very beneficial as well. And if you have other things on your credit profile that perhaps something happened in the past, you had judgments defaults or conversations where you've had to make payment arrangements and you've cleared that, make sure that that comes off your profile.
So that's the other reason why you want to check your credit rating.
On a regular basis.
To make sure that it's correct and that things have come off. So judgments, 5 years, etc. Those need, and you know, you might see, I've got a Vodacom contract. No, I don't have a Vodacom contract. What? It's been misallocated.
Yes. And especially with the increase in things like identity theft and all of that, where people are able to open up accounts and things in your name, make sure you're on top of your credit profile and you check these things. And if you have, for example, fallen behind on payments, catch up on those payments, bring them up to date, because yes, it might be painful, but in the long run, that does improve how you are scored and how that scoring system works.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it's about the score, isn't it?
It's about the score and being informed and knowledgeable is what matters.
Maintain the score, know how to get the best out of that score, extract all of the value that you absolutely can, and hopefully that can help us all in this credit journey. I mean, at the end of the day, we do what we can, and the credit score is almost, for some, it would be considered a financial passport of sorts, where things are monitored, whether you're a good or a bad person, based on a set of numbers and data that affects your life or that directly relates to your life. And unfortunately, we can't do anything about it. But we're going to leave the deep dive on that note. Before we go, if there are comments around the credit scores, if there are questions, we'd love to hear them. We'd love to get your experiences around the credit journeys. Everybody goes through a different credit journey at different times. Maybe you found ways to recover or improve a credit score quicker. We'd love to hear that. We'd love for you to share that within our community so that we can help each other better improve these things, because at the end of the day, the numbers aren't going to go away. They're always going to be a part of our lives until the government decides to change that, which doesn't seem like it's a conversation they're even having at the moment. But yes, for as long as we have this, let's make the most of it and let's see how we navigate it. We'll leave the deep dive on that note. And we wrap things up with Investor Insights. We are taking a look at companies that are doing things. We're taking a look at some of the companies we spoke about in Market Matters. If you've missed that, go check it out on our live stream tab on our YouTube page. We're going to be diving into something that we saw recently around MultiChoice. They've adjusted their pricing, and it seems that MultiChoice could potentially have finally learned from some of their mistakes in the past around pricing. But I don't know if the learnings have translated all the way through. I mean, MultiChoice as a business has been... I remember doing a conversation with, I think it was the Tech Cabal. They asked me for my thoughts around this. And I remember having a chat with another tech specialist, Mudiwa Gavaza, a very good friend of ours. He's been on the show before. He loves tech. He looks at all tech for us. And we had the same kind of conversation around DStv and the MultiChoice business, aside from the Canal Plus acquisition. And it was to say that MultiChoice and DStv have enjoyed a monopoly. And you've taken advantage of enjoying that monopoly. And consumers are now waking up to the fact that they can find alternatives. And it's been disastrous for your business. When you look at what's happened from subscriber volumes coming down to people now saying, we're just not going to do this. There was a time where I genuinely thought MultiChoice wasn't listening to its customer.
I think it wasn't. And it was, they had you, I mean, if you go back far enough, you were completely locked in, right? It was that or free to air SABC.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't have
too many options.
You didn't have much in the option space. And they weren't. They were ruthless with prices, repeats, and et cetera, et cetera. But they had you. And then the angle became, well, they've got you in the sport. They started bringing in, cheap deals around about 2010-ish, maybe 2009. Mm-hmm. Sort of you could get the compact and the like and the much cheaper platforms.
But even then, they still enjoyed a monopoly. Correct. Because there was very little competition.
Yeah.
And fast forward to where we are today, we have the likes of Netflix in, we have the likes of ESPN, Disney Plus. Everybody's coming in from a streaming perspective. Mm. And now you're waking up to a very different consumer who's saying, I refuse to pay for repeats anymore.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And a consumer who's saying, in case of streaming, so we have only one at a time going, and then when we're not, you know, we want to close that one, move to another one, it's the ease of being able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't innovated. I give you an example. Rugby World Cup and Olympics last year, I would have paid, I don't know, what, $1,000?
Mm-hmm.
If they gave me a pass to watch all the rugby or the Olympics, $1,000 each. Do they? No. I watch F1. I'm an F1 fan. I pay, I think, $60 a year, and I get it on all the different platforms. Driving back from Bella Bella yesterday, my wife's driving, I'm watching the Chinese Grand Prix.
Where? So I ask where, because I grew up on F1 with my father. He's a huge F1 fan as well. And I've always found that certain sports are difficult because Supersport has a lock on that as well, right?
Just go to F1.com.
And just pay for that subscription.
Yeah, so it used to be that you couldn't, and it was limited because, of course, they had sold non-rights to multi-choice.
Yes.
That contract, I get everything. And they've now introduced a higher tier package. I'm not sure, but the races and Alice and and I've got it across multiple devices. I've got a Chromecast 4K, so it runs on my TV. I've got it on my phone. I've got it on my iPad, and it's that sort of thing. There's going to be a time when I can pay a Springbok pass, right?
Mm.
Where I pay whatever per season, and I get all the Springbok games and all the other bits and discounts to tickets, because that's what this whole F1 app is doing.
Mm.
They're trying to sell me tickets for the next Grand Prix and et cetera, et cetera.
And you know what? For me, that is the evolution of broadcasting, right? So
correct.
I had a conversation with the CEO of Supersport around how it is that as a broadcaster, you're making your money and all of those sorts of things. Now, Supersport has a very interesting value proposition, is that they've got quite a bit of a lock on the sporting world in general. So they get the rights ahead of everybody else and say, we want the rights to this, 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 this. And you know that you've got that intellectual property that you then leverage into a MultiChoice, into an SABC, into whatever. But that's how you secure your spot in the value chain.
Yeah.
But as the consumer, I might only want one thing out of a package. I don't need to be paying 5,000 Rand for a DStv package. It's not that expensive. I am exaggerating.
It
feels like it. But I don't need to be paying all of that much if I'm not going to be utilizing that from a value perspective. And I think consumers right now are looking for value. If you're offering me value,
that's actually a great
point. Why I'm happy to pay 100 Rand for Netflix
because
or whatever.
20 years ago, even 10, 15 years ago, 30 years ago, it was the look at all what you've got, 100 plus channels. That was their marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the quantum that we had that was, yo. And now we're sort of like saying, yeah, 100 channels, but I watch three of them, folks. Like really, 90. But of course, those 97 channels cost them collectively $2.50. And that's not where they're making the money. We want to watch a series, which the streaming services are on.
Mm-hmm.
Sign up for that one.
And that's the thing. On that, right? So a lot of the... And I mean, the conversation's now morphed into a streaming conversation, right? So if you think about your premium from a DStv premium package perspective, it's now going to be sitting just under 1,000 Rand a month. For that 1,000 Rand, you could allocate a 200 Rand to a Disney Plus. You can allocate a 200 Rand to a Netflix. You can allocate a 200 Rand to an Amazon Prime. You can allocate a 200 Rand to an online F1 subscription. You get four different subscription services, far more variety, and you've gotten around the premium, the restrictions on the premium package.
But what you don't have there is
That's true, but you're getting
the problem.
But what you're getting there is guys like Disney Plus that have ESPN rights can start to incorporate that.
Yes.
But there's also nothing stopping a SuperSport from saying, hey, pay 200 Rand directly to SuperSport so you don't have to go through multi-choice to get access to our product. At some point, that's a conversation that surely happens at some point for consumers where SuperSport then sees and says, but we can if you've got a rev share agreement as a business, say we split the revenues 60-40 or whatever, and then you suddenly realize that actually I can get 100% of the revenues because this is what people actually want, and you just offer them what they want. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, but that's the evolution of how we got to a Netflix, how we got to a Disney Plus, how we got to an Amazon.
It's how it's happening in the US, and you will see in the US. So, I mean, what's happened is their Comcast cable is like even more expensive than. I mean, I know peeps who are paying $200 for Comcast cable. Now that includes internet, but it's also their TV. And so you strip all that away, then you end up signing all these different bundles, and you're actually paying more. But what we are seeing is the different sports in America. What do they call it? Football, gridiron. That we had the basketball, the NBA, baseball, all of those sports are kind of siloing themselves and saying,
this is a base sport.
Yes. This is where you come and do it. And yes, you've also then got ESPN, which is part of Disney, which is weirdly struggling a bit, not available locally. And I think the issue there is how the rights are sold off, how the global rights are sold. But it will go that way, and MultiChoice will go there kicking and screaming because they've run the numbers, and they know that person paying 1,000 Rand a month, if they let you pay just 200 for sport, there's 800 Rand that walks out the door.
Absolutely. But at the same time, you can't force the 800 Rand to stay there. Correct. For the sake of so you have to then give them value for that 1,000 Rand, right? Yeah, and that's your responsibility as a broadcaster. And on the streaming side of it, I mean, we've seen a lot of guys try the stream. We've seen the MultiChoice business try the Showmax thing, launch a Showmax 2.0. They've now got Disney Stream as well, or DStv Stream rather. And that is also now, again, it's not about just throwing streaming products at me. It's what value am I getting for those streaming products? Because if you're still charging me 700-800 Rand or 600 Rand for a stream account, or even 300 Rand for a stream account, and I'm getting no value out of it. DStv has quite a few challenges around locking different channels and all of those sorts of things and the repeats and all of that. But the consumer is very clear now about what they want.
Yes.
And the guys that are producing the content are even clearer. So certain content and I saw this, Amazon went and paid for the rights to the Bond franchise. Now you know that all of the Bond movies are going to be found only on an Amazon platform. When Disney went and took all of their content off of Netflix, they were willing to pay that clause to release their content out of Netflix, that settlement agreement. It was in the billions. And this is what the content creators and producers are realizing, that if we control our content, then if someone wants our content, they have to come to us. Yeah. So if that is the way that the content management side of it is going to go, then what is your value add to the consumer? Because that's what I'm paying for, right? As the consumer, from a streaming side, from a whatever consumption it is, I want to consume things, and I now know that I have the flexibility to consume things my way. You're not going to force me to consume things that I didn't want to consume in the past.
Yeah.
And if you don't adapt your business model,
you're dead. And I just searched ESPN in South Africa and on Perplexity, and they're telling me about VPNs.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not even concerned about that, because that's a flick of a switch, right? For someone like a Disney Plus to come back and say, oh, you guys want this, here you go.
It is going to happen. This isn't
Dev work that goes into it. It's not infrastructure
but
development.
But I tell you what my best $79 a month is.
Mm-hmm.
Google Premium.
Google Premium.
It takes the adverts away. And so YouTube Premium.
Okay.
Takes the adverts away.
Okay.
You
don't like adverts.
Yeah. The YouTube advert. It's what my wife and I watch probably most.
Yes.
Is YouTube. On big screen, we've got the Chromecast 4K,
mm-hmm.
and we're watching on big screen, and take the adverts away.
Folks, Let us know what your most expensive premium is, what your most expensive subscription is, and what your happiest subscription is. The one subscription you will pay no matter what it costs because you get exceptional value out of it, or just because you like what it is that they offer. We'd love to hear that. Let us know. Engage. Pop it into the comment sections of our videos. Send us mails. We definitely want to know your experiences from a streaming perspective and what you're happy to pay for. So that's going to be our streaming chat. I mean, that's going to be where we're going to leave the streaming conversation. We're going to update our wall because there's a couple of things we want to be looking at from that perspective. You might see us add some things, take some things off. We're still in two minds around what's happening with our wall. We know we haven't been putting it out in the public domain, and that's because a lot of the conversations that we've been getting from our community has been to say that the wall is a lot of value. You guys really like the wall, and we thought maybe we would have that wall be something special for you guys. So we're looking to see if we can make it even more special for our community, for those that have been with us for the longest time, and we appreciate you guys. I want to look at the AI conversation because we had that conversation. We have to be having AI on the wall at some point. Do we then, how do we approach that? Do you go AI stocks or companies investing in AI? Do you go Nvidia? Where along the value chain do you go? Because guys, and we've spoken about this, guys like Facebook or guys like Meta and all of those other platforms are putting their R&D budgets into buying the chips to develop their own AIs. But at the same time, a Copilot, a Grok, a ChatGPT are three different companies. Do you invest in the company that's got the best AI? I'd happen to think not, because all AIs have different uses. Yeah. And I happen to think you go all the way back to someone like a Taiwan Semiconductor or an ASMR ASML that you mentioned last week to say those guys supply all of them.
They winner agnostic. So even right at the base, it's ASML because they make the kit that makes the chips. Then you've got the chip maker, which is at the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company.
And NVIDIA.
And then the step up is NVIDIA. So NVIDIA designs and then they make them here. So NVIDIA, and you could perhaps to a degree bring ARM and others in, I'm not sure. But absolutely, I think that is the better space, because with Meta and Alphabet and Microsoft and all the others, and there are lots of them putting a lot of money into it, you've also got all the other stuff there. I mean, you know, Meta,
subscriptions and
Meta's making money from Facebook as an advertising
Facebook
company.
Facebook ads, yes.
Alphabet's largely an advertising company, and we've spoken before around how Facebook solved the Apple lockdown with AI. They did, but I don't know where the revenue is going to come from. And then Meta, open source, well, Llama is open source anyway. So then it's a case of, well, I mean, is AI going to be big? Is it big? Is it around? 100%. How do we benefit? Well, go to a different part of the value chain.
Absolutely. So I happen to think from a value chain perspective, I don't really see a value in going to the end part of the value chain because everybody has a different use case. How does Microsoft quantify exactly how much money Copilot has made them since its introduction and how much it adds to the bottom line? Whereas if you go all the way back to an ASML, you're increasing your concentration risk towards the AI sector, but that's the play that you're going for anyway.
But it's also, if AI ends up being not a hot thing somehow, that's fine, because the Taiwan people make chips for Apple
other things as well.
And make no mistake, we are using more and more.
So the AI play is to definitely go as far back in the value chain or unlock those pockets in the value chain. And I think that's also the same with something like the mining space or any other space really that you look at, depending on what your level of concentration needs to be towards it. So say, for example, you were looking at a Bitcoin kind of conversation. One person might say, I want direct exposure to Bitcoin, to the cryptocurrency, to the volatility that comes with that. Another person might say, I want to back blockchain technology in its advancements, not in its use case towards crypto, in its use case towards banking, CBDCs, everything else. And so you do a blockchain play, not necessarily a Bitcoin play. You know what I mean? So even with the AI, I completely agree with you. There's different areas of the value chain, but you and I are on the same side. It's the value chain that is agnostic of market noise.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, 100%. Mm. And it's also, as it evolves, those companies will evolve with it. There, you know, if you saw Jensen Huang's speech last week at GDC from NVIDIA, and he's talking...
Where he introduced the new computer or something.
Yeah, he's good. He is, I mean, for him, AI is in the rearview mirror already. He's looking at new things. And the big one for him is autonomous driving, which is, a lot of it is AI. But yeah.
And that's a new use case, right? But again, that doesn't take away from the need for the chips, the manufacturing for the chips, the process behind that. It just adds a new use case to diversify revenues at the end side of it. Yeah. But the core of where the value sits still sits from that perspective. So we're definitely going to add AI to our wall. We're definitely going to add the use cases and where we like AI to be. We're on the same page around that. And I think that's something else perhaps you guys can weigh in on as a community. Tell us where you are seeing AI going, what you are liking about AI, what areas of interest we might not have thought of. Because there's new use cases, like the autonomous vehicle side of it. There's new use cases that are coming up for AI. I, for one, happen
medical,
to think...
Medical.
I was going to go with data, but take data me through medical. No, medical's so, interesting. So, what's
I mean,
happening
well,
there?
So medical. So, I mean, there are AI systems that can detect breast cancer in women with better efficiency and 6 months before doctors can. We don't know how it works. Mm. I mean, it's just stuff like that. Solving for disease and all of that. I mean, you've got the sort of robotic medical companies already, which are quite fancily done, but the ability to, for example, take an R&D process, which is typically can take forever to do, and to throw it into a AI machine, not a large language model, probably a small language model, because you're going to refine what you want to use and let that run at it and come up with ideas. And that is going to be, I mean, we're going to see crazy stuff coming out of there.
No, and this is the thing. For me, artificial intelligence doesn't really stand for, or AI doesn't really stand for artificial intelligence. Mm. It's more around aggregation of information. Because you can aggregate information across any sector, across any industry, across any value chain, any use case. And it's about how you apply that information, like you said, in the detection of things like breast cancer, how you use that information. There's so much information out there. And I think the key role of AI is going to be in bringing all that information together and condensing it into a simple and easy thing to use. So there's lots of value from that perspective. There's lots of things that can be found in that space. And yes, we'd love to hear your thoughts around what you're thinking could be the future of where we go to from here. What else are we adding to the wall?
Momentum.
Oh, you and I spoke about momentum this morning.
This morning. Jen, I mean, we see lots of results. We get jaded.
We do. Results season is quite hectic for us,
And then momentum comes late in the season and says, everybody step aside. Look what we have.
Small 50%.
Little billion-dollar rand buyback. 50% numbers everywhere, left, right, and center. And still trading 20-plus percent discount to embedded value. Now, insurers are difficult to truly understand, and they carry risks for all those sorts of, you know, things can go horribly wrong. But man, momentum.
Just to get, I mean, for those that haven't seen the momentum results, just to give you a bit of context around what's been happening there, they gave us a half-year update and earnings were up 53%, headline earnings up 52%. I'm just going to run through some of these cliff notes here. interim dividend per share up 42%. Not just double-digit growth in terms of some of these metrics. Operating profit 33% up. This is double-digit on another level, right? And as you said, Si, buybacks announced, dividends announced. The business is not struggling. They are extremely cash generative. They are definitely jumping onto our wall. The question is, where do we put them on the wall? I want to see where they're trading at the moment.
32-ish. Embedded values 39-ish. I mean, small things like value of new business up 40%. Yeah. But the business margin goes up. I mean, it's just like everything about this was like, you know who's been on this stock for a long time is Keith McLachlan.
Really?
He's long since
last. And we're approaching all-time, or at least the last 10 years highs. 2015 highs go quite far. 2015 highs are around, I think the highest we got to in 2015 was probably around 34 Rand 70 or so, and we're just under 33 Rand. So we're basically at 10-year highs on the stock, and it's very interesting that the performance has rebounded from pandemic lows of below 50. 15 rand to basically, if you'd gotten in the pandemic, you would have doubled your money by now.
Yeah, and we have to be clear, the billion share buyback is not the one that they did last year.
It's
the new one for this year.
It's the new one for the new half year.
Also true.
For now, because we don't know what they've announced for the full year. It's announced for the full year, but they could easily come back at the end of the year and say, hey, we did another buyback, or we approved another buyback. For a business to be cash generative and generate that much money, I absolutely agree. They get to make our wall. Hopefully, if you are looking at this, that we can see them break above these highs and see them go and do a lot better as a business. This is all-time highs for them. So beyond this is unknown territory, but we look forward to it because we like seeing our companies do exceptionally well wherever they can.
I'm wondering what the embedded value was back at those previous levels.
At 2015 levels.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That would be interesting to see.
I'm going to see if Perplexity can find it. What was Momentum Group embedded value in 2015? Let's see if Perplexity should be able to say to me. Yeah, so it gave me 2024. yeah, you're just stupid. Oh, no, yeah, okay, my bad. June 15, it was 25 Rand. So it was trading at that point at a 40% premium to embedded value. It's now trading at a 20% discount to embedded value. Where do you want to be buying it?
There we go, right? So that's something that's going to make our wall. We're going to update the wall. We're going to move a couple of things around if we need to. We have liked a couple of things that we've needed to put on there. But we're going to leave the show on that note. Thanks, folks, for tuning in. If you've missed the conversations, you know exactly where to catch up on them. The live stream is updated separately, so it would have been uploaded before this. You know where to catch up on these episodes. And we're going to leave you, as we always do, with our unfiltered opinion of the week. We never leave you without one of those, because we feel like it's important to your lives and it's important to our lives. This week's unfiltered opinion is courtesy of the beverage companies that we enjoy, the likes of Starbucks and Seattle and Kauai and all of those. And it's a very particular one.
Mm-hmm.
And people might not agree with this, but I think that our community and the vast majority of people around the world will agree with this. There is too much ice and too little everything else in cold beverages that are made by these companies. I am paying to get money or get value for my money, and I get a cup full of ice and that much of everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't realize it. And this isn't limited to these beverage companies. It extends to the likes of the McDonald's that give you a fountain cold drinks and that have ice. Any closed cup that has ice in it with your beverage, you get less beverage. Companies out there, stop putting so much ice in things. If I wanted more ice, I'd get a separate cup of water and have that into the drink, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's my unfiltered opinion of the week. Too much ice, too little everything else. That's the show. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Investing isn't hard. Just try it.